For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sale, and today we're focusing on the six novels shortlisted for this year's Booker Prize. Established in 1969, the Booker is the world's oldest and most highly respected prize for literary fiction, and has been awarded to some of the world's most influential authors writing in English over the last half century. This year, more than ever, there really was an international flavour to the shortlist, and I've recorded interviews with authors living in Zimbabwe, Dubai, Michigan, Iowa City, and two from New York. So sit back and enjoy this Read On Booker Prize special.
Tsitsi Dambarenka is a Zimbabwean novelist, playwright, and filmmaker. Her debut novel, Nervous Conditions, published in 1988, was recently named by the BBC as one of the top 100 novels that have shaped the world. And now, the third book in the series, This Mournable Body, has been shortlisted for this year's Booker Prize. In fact, 2020 has been quite a year for Tsitsi, as she told me when she joined me from her home in Harare. Like your previous novels in the series, This Mournable Body starts in the middle of the action with Tambu being ejected from a hostel for women because she's too old.
Yes, that's how This Mournable Body begins. And I have tended to begin in the middle of the action, mainly because I do look at characters. And so it's good to start with something, an action that brings the reader into the character's life.
She's a very complicated character herself. From the very beginning in the late 1960s in Nervous Conditions, we see her as very hardworking with utter faith in education and hard work to take her forward. But that's to the exclusion of a softer side of her.
Yes, very definitely. We do see Tambu as a very dedicated, hardworking character. And that is something that is usually seen with achieving women in my part of the world, where options are not all that numerous and life is hard. And so people do have to be very ambitious and almost driven to achieve anything. And I do think that, as you say, being so driven and so ambitious and so focused can lead to neglecting softer, gentler sides of character. And that is one of the issues that I wanted to highlight in the series.
That evening, it is as though the hostel has folded its arms more tightly against you. You feel this the minute you walk into the dining room and see Gertrude. She is sitting at her group's table, where the young women talk about the latest lipsticks and vie with each other to be the best loved of or worst abused by their respective boyfriends. You never sit at their table.
Certainly in this book, Tambu is rather haunted by images of her mother and actually questions herself at one point, saying, with all this education, why should I have more worries than my mother, who, well, has never been an educated woman and is still in the same place as she was born?
Yes, that is another aspect of our circumstances in Zimbabwean contemporary culture, and I think also in African contemporary culture, that I wanted to examine. The idea of education was that it took you away from your poverty. And of course, poverty is linked to place. If you're in a rural area, you are definitely going to suffer certain kinds of poverty that you're not going to suffer if you are in an urban area. And so I really did want to show how being successful and having a good life actually means moving away from the place where you were born and the place where many members of your family also remain. And I think that is an issue that we have to contend with in contemporary African society.
And this is very much the story of post-colonial Zimbabwe. The trilogy starts in the late 1960s, and This Mournable Body takes us through the latter years of the 1990s. And we've seen Tambu corrupted by the system, I suppose, she is a reflection of the dashed hopes of a young nation.
Absolutely. Tambudzai's personal development does parallel in many ways the development of the country, the trajectory that Zimbabwe has taken since 1980. The thing is, Tambudzai is powerless. Apart from her intellectual power, she had absolutely nothing to offer. Whereas where the country is concerned, there are people with power who could change things if they wanted to. And they resolutely refuse to do that. They say that they do no wrong. They refuse to listen to any people who wish to engage them about the situation. And so that is where there is a difference. The people are powerless to change their situation as individuals trying to fight their way through life. And this is why right at the end of this mournable body, Tambudzai actually goes back to live with her aunt Lucia, a woman who had offered her somewhere to live and a job earlier in the book, which she had refused. So basically, the idea is that we cannot create better lives for ourselves as individuals, and we have to embrace all of ourselves and all of us in order to find that force that we need to move forward.
You are obviously still politically active in Zimbabwe, and the announcement of your being shortlisted for this year's Booker Prize coincided almost exactly with your being arrested for protesting against corruption. Has the book helped raise your profile and make you a little safer within Zimbabwe, or has it done the opposite?
Yes, well, Red, I don't see myself as being politically active as such. I see myself as being a conscientious and concerned citizen of Zimbabwe, which means if I see things not working as they should, I should engage. So that is what I do in the ways that I'm able to do it. And yes, I was arrested for protesting against corruption, but not only corruption. In my opinion, corruption is a symptom of other things that are going wrong. And so there are all sorts of things that are wrong with the government here. And so generally, I think that we need to be talking more about misgovernance, of which corruption is a symptom. The exposure that I received from having been longlisted and then shortlisted this year's Booker Prize has been useful in that the story of my arrest became international news, and I think would not have resonated internationally if I hadn't been in that position. And what is important about that is not so much that I as a person have done anything particular, but the important thing is that when people do things that are wrong, they do not want that to be known. And so uncovering and telling the story of the things that are going on in Zimbabwe, which should not be going on, is a very important thing to do. And it is very difficult for Zimbabweans to get their stories out because most of the media is utterly controlled by the state. So that was the important aspect, that it was an opportunity, an opening, a window for the story to go out. And I think that has really made a difference.
Well, Sitsi, I'm delighted that you are able to talk to us, and many congratulations on being shortlisted for this year's Booker Prize.
Thank you, Red. My pleasure.
The winner of the inaugural Booker Prize in 1969 was P.H. Newby with Something to Answer For.
Douglas Stewart is a Scottish-American author whose novel Shuggy Bane is one of four debuts shortlisted for this year's Booker Prize. It's a heartrending account of poverty and addiction set in 1980s Glasgow, a place that Douglas knows well, as he told me when he joined me from his home in New York.
Shuggy Bane is actually a portrait of the Bane family who are living in 1980s Glasgow. It is a love story at its heart, but it is the love story that looks at how children can have a very unconditional, tenacious love for parents who are a little bit flawed or who are suffering with addiction. We follow the mother of the family, Agnes Bane, who is a very beautiful, driven, ambitious, but a little bit proud and a little bit vain mother. And as her marriage is starting to come apart, she finds herself slipping getting into alcoholism. The beginning of the book, everyone sort of thinks of Agnes as being too much. She is too much, she's exhausting. But actually, it's not that Agnes is too much, it's that the world around her is not enough. And so after she is abandoned by her husband in a coal mining town that is similarly being shut down by the Thatcher government, she starts to sort of slide into her addiction. And it is her three children, Catherine, Leek, and then the baby of the family, Shuggy, who stay by her side and try to save their mother from herself. Now, as Agnes is a little bit isolated, Shuggy, her youngest son, is also isolated because although he's a very young boy, he is growing up to be not like the other boys. And everyone around him very quickly identifies him as no right, as what they say in the book, meaning he's very sort of precocious. He's a little bit effeminate. And so it's really this lovely portrait of love and how people cling to each other to survive as Agnes and Shuggy try to make their way through the world. The book asks the question of all of us of how far would you go to save the person you love the most before you have to save yourself? And so we see all three of Agnes's children wrangle with that and wrestle with that question. I grew up in Glasgow of the 80s, and I think the thing I haven't told you yet is my own mother suffered with addiction. And when I was a child, she actually died of her alcoholism. And so I write a lot about the feelings of that pain, that exhaustion that children can feel there from the inside. Although the book is absolutely not a memoir, it is a work of fiction. I understand it because I've lived the same similar life that Shuggy did. And he is clinging on to his mother till the very end. The book actually starts to become quite political and looks a lot at a society that is struggling. But I'd actually only set out to write a very intimate story, a love story between a mother and son.
You say the book broadened out into something a lot more political. Was that, in a sense, looking for someone to blame, or was that trying to make sense of what had happened to your own family and others who had been through those same years?
That's a wonderful question. I think we could talk about that all day. I think, first of all, when you are a child and you go through the trauma of unemployment, the trauma of being overlooked, the trauma of being gay in a patriarchal society, and also what it means to love and lose a parent from addiction, then a lot happens to you that you don't really have control over. And so the very first thing about writing a book is the writer has control, and especially when you take sort of a lot of pain and make it fiction. And so for me, writing the book gave me a lot of ability to access my pain and access my trauma, but also to take control of it and to twist it into whatever I saw. But also, I'm a huge fan of working class literature. I'm a huge fan of West of Scotland writing, but I'd always known it to be centered around a working man or a young man's point of view. And I'd never known that to be the world or the Glasgow that I knew. As the queer son of a single mother, my entire universe was women. I was raised around women, whether those were women on the housing scheme or whether there were other women that my mother socialized through Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew women to be the strength of the city, but I rarely got to read about them and their children in these huge West of Scotland books. And so when I say I didn't want it to be political, I really did want it to be an intimate story about what it meant to be a woman in the time, what it meant to be a young queer boy in the time. You can't really set a book in Glasgow in the 1980s without addressing the political, without looking at unemployment and addiction and mental health issues, and also the failed 1950s and 60s housing scheme design that then started to crumble by the 70s and 80s. And I tend to think of it as a bit of an ecosystem that maybe isn't very healthy or working.
One of the wonderful things about this book is the Glaswegian dialect that floods through it.
As a writer, one of my pleasures is actually writing dialogue. And I couldn't imagine writing a book about Glasgow without really leaning into Broad Scots or the Glaswegian dialect. I find it really expressive and funny, and oftentimes quite unsettling how sentences can go together. They can be incredibly tender, but they sound incredibly brutal, or they can be very sad, but they're incredibly funny. And so that was one of the great pleasures of writing the book. But the book actually has lots of different layers in it because, as I said earlier, the main character of Agnes Bain is sort of affecting airs and graces. She's not letting her neighbours, who she's absolutely identical to, believe that she is struggling in the same way that they are. And so she speaks in a very standard English, or a very Queen's English, because she wants to be perceived as above her neighbours. And so I even love the different levels of that and how that creates tension and how that creates separation between people who are identical. But when I first wrote the book, I wasn't thinking about the gaze of anyone else. I was thinking about writing it in honor of the people that I was writing about. And so in order to do that, you write with as much honesty as you can, and you write it as truthfully to the Glaswegian dialect as you can manage.
Well, the book has been wonderfully brought to life by Angus King, who really captures all those separate voices.
He'd worked for Kilfeathers for over a year. It was never meant to be that long. It was just that he had to feed himself and pay his own dig money each week, and the supermarket was the only business that would take him. Mr. Kilfeather was a parsimonious bastard. He liked to staff the shop with anyone he didn't have to pay a full adult wage, and Shuggy found himself able to take short shifts that fit around his patchy schooling.
Angus King, narrating Shuggy Bane, written by my guest, Douglas Stewart.
Angus stuck out to me because he had such an expressive voice, and the book is populated by a real chorus of characters and also a lot of women. And I could tell just from the little clip that was submitted to me that he would be able to capture all the different levels of that and really bring them to life. You know, I think most writers, if they can, would love to narrate their own books, and I've certainly narrated a lot of my own short stories, but I just knew this task was beyond me because there are so many characters in the book. Because I think that's part of writing about working class Glasgow, you know, it's a collective moment. That how he remembers all of their inflections and their tones and their little tics and how they speak is really remarkable.
Douglas Stewart, thank you so much for taking us further into the world of Shuggy Bane, and many congratulations on being shortlisted for this year's Booker Prize.
Thank you very much, Red, and thank you for having me.
Did you know that the longest winning novel was 2013's The Luminaries by Eleanor Catton, which came in at a whopping 832 pages, or 29 hours and 15 minutes if you listen to the talking book. She was also the youngest ever winner at the tender age of 28.
Avni Doshi's debut novel, Burnt Sugar, is a frank exploration of a mother-daughter relationship gone sour. Set in India, it's one of four debut novels that has been shortlisted for this year's Booker Prize. She joined me from her home in Dubai to tell me more about the book and the recognition that the Booker Prize has brought her.
Burnt Sugar is the story of a mother and daughter who have a very difficult relationship, and the mother develops Alzheimer's disease, and her daughter is now faced with a kind of dilemma. How does she look after this woman who never really was there for her when she was a child? And so it's a story about mothers and daughters and family. It's a story about being a caretaker for your elderly parent. It's a story about art. And it's also a story about betrayal.
Tara, the mother, followed her own path when she was her daughter's age. She ran away from a middle-class home in India and joined an ashram and experimented with free love. And all the way along, she had her infant daughter, Antara, who was just baggage rather than somebody she had a loving relationship with.
Yeah, when I was thinking about Tara, the mother character, I was thinking about the kind of embodiment of desire. And what does desire look like when it's unbridled, unhampered? How does desire circulate in us as individuals, in society, within families? What happens when we are no longer hemmed in by societal expectations and can kind of act on our desires? And so it was a journey into thinking through what that kind of an individual would look like. And so she was actually a really interesting character to write, although a difficult individual for her daughter. But she was interesting because she goes against a lot of societal norms, particularly in the context of India.
Anthara now is not only having to care for a mother who didn't appear to care for her, but she's also having to care for a young baby and experiencing postnatal depression.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's actually probably not a very uncommon experience for women of my generation, at least, because you see more and more that parents are living longer and longer and need to be looked after, and a lot of women are having children perhaps a bit later. And so you can end up at this moment where you're not only looking after young children, but you're looking after parents who are struggling perhaps with degenerative diseases, who are aging and so in a sense are perhaps more dependent on you in a way. And so I think she's found herself at this moment where she is a caretaker for the younger generation as well as the older one.
Well, it's interesting that yours is one of four books on this year's Booker shortlist that deal with troublesome relationships between children and their parents. Do you think that's something of particular interest to millennial writers who have been brought up by very independent, liberal-minded parents and are wondering exactly what they're inheriting?
I definitely think that's a part of it. Also, this is sort of a generation where we're really questioning how we are the product of this type of parenting. And we're really looking closely at how children are very much a product of their parents. I wonder to what degree past generations really believed this. And maybe I'm wrong about this, but I think to some degree there was an expectation that no matter how you were brought up, you would pull yourself up by your bootstraps or create your own destiny. And I think with this generation, there's a sense of the limitations that are put on you by your upbringing, and that there's an idea that you may actually never be able to escape from that. There's also a greater openness to blaming your parents for things. I don't know if in the past, previous generations dared to do that. There was perhaps, at least I think in the Indian context, there was too much respect for the parents' generation to really look at them in a critical light. But I think what Antara does in the novel is she really doesn't shy away from picking her mother apart and by extension, picking herself apart.
The book has been brought wonderfully to life by Vinita Rishi. Did you have anything to do with the selection of her?
You know, I actually had no idea what went into creating an audiobook until the wonderful team at Penguin UK said, you know, we're making the audiobook and we have some actors. We'd like you to listen to them and tell us what you think. And as soon as we heard Vinita Rishi reading, we knew that she kind of had the right tone, and she brought a seriousness and humor to the narrator's voice that really resonated for us. So yeah, it was really interesting and fun for me because I didn't really know all that went into the making of an audiobook.
I've noted down many things about my mother. The hour she falls asleep at night when her reading glasses slip down the greasy slide of her nose, or the number of Mazarin filos she eats for breakfast. I have been keeping track of these details. I know the skirted responsibilities and where the surface of story has been buffed smooth. Sometimes when I visit her, she asks me to phone friends who are long dead. My mother was a woman who could memorize recipes she had only read once. She could recall variations of tea made in other people's homes. When she cooked, she reached out for bottles and masalas without glancing up.
Vinita Rishi, narrating Burnt Sugar, written by my guest, Avni Doshi. Are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
Now I think I will be. I'm going to definitely give some a try. I had not until this point listened to any. But after being a little involved and hearing an audiobook for Burnt Sugar, I'm interested in listening to more, especially in terms of autobiography and memoir, because I think it would be wonderful to hear those books in the voice of the person who's writing them.
And have you started work on a second novel yet, or are you still enjoying the shortlisting for the Booker Prize?
I've been really busy, actually, with two young children and, of course, all the wonderful press and attention from the Booker. It's actually kept me really busy, so I haven't been able to start anything new, but I'm hoping to start something before the end of the year, and I'm sure it will be a novel. I'm not sure I know how to write anything else.
Well, I hope that you'll come back onto the show to talk about it in the future.
Absolutely, I absolutely will.
Avni Doshi, thank you so much for coming onto the show and taking us into the world of Burnt Sugar.
Thank you so much for having me.
And now, here's another Booker fact. Since 1969, four authors have won the prize more than once. J.M. Coetzee, Peter Carey, Hilary Mantel, and last year, Margaret Atwood won it for the second time when she shared the prize with Bernardine Evaristo.
The New Wilderness is Diane Cook's debut novel, and like the collection of short stories that preceded it, Man v. Nature, it focuses on the damaging effect that human communities have on their environment. Its reflections on human interaction during a time of crisis have certainly struck a chord with many readers. Diane joined me from her home in Michigan to tell me more.
It's a speculative novel that looks at a world post-climate change. It imagines that there's one wilderness area left in this country I don't name, but it's the U.S. in my mind. And the novel follows a group of people who live there in a kind of scientific experiment to see if people and nature can interact and coexist any longer. Most of the people live in a really huge, polluted city, and this is the only place where you're able to roam freely on land. So it's looking at the environment, nature, people, community, and it also is following the main characters who are Bee and Agnes. Bee is Agnes's mother, and it's looking at their difficult relationship, but a relationship where the one would do almost anything for the other.
Bee, the mother, has moved from the megacity because Agnes has respiratory problems, and she sees that volunteering to go to the New Wilderness is really the best hope for Agnes's health.
Yeah, so all of the participants in the study like have their own reasons for going, and that's her reason. Basically, doctors have told her that Agnes will die if she stays in the city. The air quality is poor and a lot of children are really sick. So she makes the decision to go live in this place. And I forgot to mention probably the most important part of the book is that in the wilderness area, they have to live as these kind of prehistoric hunter-gatherers. They're nomadic. They can't dwell anywhere. They can't set up homes. They can't farm. They really just have to move from place to place to place, like people did very long ago, like any animal would. The whole idea is that they make the least amount of impact as possible on the land. So the life that she is choosing for her daughter in order to save her daughter's life is very hard. It's a completely different life than the one she's used to living in the city. So it's this ultimate sacrifice that a mother makes for a daughter, but it's like this really extreme sacrifice. And I wanted to look at the ways that that kind of love and that kind of loyalty, that kind of sacrifice can also alter a relationship.
As you say, it is a very harsh environment. Physically, you reflect on the fact that most of them started off with 10 fingers and toes, but they've been whittled down over the period of 3 years. It's also a police state. The wilderness rangers are constantly on their case for micro-littering.
Yeah, maybe you've spent a lot of time in natural places or wilderness areas, but there are a lot of regulations to them in order to keep them clean and wild and free of intensive human impact. So I just took that idea to its extreme and made this place somewhere that, you know, it's the last one of its kind, so the rules are even more strict. I've always been really interested in the idea of wilderness as a thing that we put a lot of meaning into, but it's really just an idea that doesn't even really apply to the natural world. It's more of a man-made idea than it is a natural ideal. So I was really interested in having this place where you would assume that people might feel free, you know, because there's no boundaries, and yet it's probably more policed and more regulated than their life in the city. I think the definition of wilderness is like a place a mile from any kind of human structure or road. That's technically a wilderness. And it's funny that the entire concept of wilderness centers around its proximity to humanity. And that means humanity can't be anywhere near a wild area. Otherwise, it becomes not wild anymore.
Something you could not have anticipated, of course, is the global pandemic, which seems to have caused an awful lot of readers to identify with the New Wilderness and the examination of our interaction with those around us in a pressurized environment.
Yeah, it's been really interesting to hear from readers who are encountering the book now during this really weird, awful time. Of course, when I wrote it, I had none of that in my head. I have all these other associations, other weird, awful times that, that we've been through as a global community. But it's been really interesting to think about borders being shut and people kind of being stuck where they are and not having a way to flee their situation. And that was definitely one of the impulses that was driving me when I first was beginning to think about this book. It was like, well, what happens when there's nowhere left to go, when you really are just stuck in the situation and the place where you are because all land is being used or borders aren't open or there's just nowhere left to explore or there's a reason why you can't go somewhere. So it's been really interesting to have this come out during a time when people are feeling some of the feelings that are present in the book. And I think it's heightening people's reading experience of it for sure.
Well, the book is fully accessible to blind and partially sighted readers thanks to the Booker Foundation's support of the RNIB library. You must be delighted that it's reaching an audience who might not otherwise be able to read the book.
Oh, definitely. I've heard that people really love the audiobook version. I'm really happy about that because I think really it takes a good actor and a really good producer to make a good audiobook. And I'm really glad that it seems to have been working. I want people to be able to access it and hear it or experience it. And I imagine also someone narrating it to them allows them to lose themselves in the world. And it's a really rich world to get lost in.
They came to call it the Big Walk because they walked for the duration of a whole season and a portion of the next before they even reached foothills for the very first of the three mountain ranges they were meant to cross. On the Big Walk, they passed through entirely new landscapes, tumbled into grasslands that smelled of nutmeg after a rain. Bugling elk crowded valleys with sounds of a lost world, the animal equivalent of a haunting, lonesome whistle from the refineries outside the city. They passed into regions of low, strange mountains, a mix of jagged, licking peaks and mellow, rolling, red-capped hills.
Stacey Glebowski, narrating The New Wilderness, written by my guest, Diane Cook.
What's interesting is that when I started the book, I thought that this was going to be a really hard sell, in that, you know, it would take a lot for me to be able to convince a reader that this world could become a possibility. But I think by the time I finished it, it felt a lot more possible, unfortunately.
Well, Diane Cook, many congratulations on being shortlisted for this year's Booker Prize. And thank you very much for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you for having me.
And now, before we hear from another shortlisted author, here's another Booker fact. The Booker Prize has been jointly split between two authors on three previous occasions. Nadine Gordimer and Stanley Middleton in 1974, Michael Ondaatje and Barry Unsworth in 1992, and Margaret Atwood and Bernardine Evaristo last year. Will the same thing happen again this year? Who knows? But here is one of the hopefuls to tell us about their book.
4 years ago, Brandon Taylor abandoned his postgraduate studies in biochemistry to focus on creative writing. His debut novel, Real Life, has been published to great acclaim and been shortlisted for this year's Booker Prize. In it, he puts loneliness, desire, and finding a meaning to life under the microscope, as he told me when he joined me from his home in Iowa City.
Real Life is a novel about a young man, Wallace, who is black and gay, and he's from the American South, and he's currently studying biochemistry at a Midwestern university. And the novel opens on one of those typical Fridays in grad school when you find out your experiment that you've been working on all summer has been ruined. And Wallace chooses to go to the lake with his friends for the first time in many years. And it sets into motion a series of confrontations and collisions among his friends and in his personal and professional life as he reckons with what is a real life and what does he want from the life he's chosen.
And he's very much a young man who finds solace in work or study. But when that's disrupted, it gives him a bit of an existential crisis.
Yes, I think Wallace, like many people of our generation, we over-identify with our work because we've had to make a series of concessions to winnow our lives down to survive our circumstances. And when the thing that you've identified as your way of being and the only way you have of understanding yourself and your value to the world is threatened, it does send you spiraling out into what even am I outside of this very narrow context of biomedical research? What am I without my work? And I think it's when his research is threatened that he realizes that that is actually what he's done. And he's like, oh, I have given up every other thing in my life. And the only thing I have is this work. And now it's ruined. And who even am I?
There's very much a sense that he doesn't feel he's living up to his own expectations. But overarching all of this are the expectations or inbuilt prejudices of the university that he's at. It's a liberal white campus, which would be mortified to think that it is racist, but by its own belief in its utopian liberal ideals, it can't see that a lot of what it does undercut Wallace's self-belief.
Yes. And I think that this is true of many things in the world, is that people believe that they are good. And very often they are good, but they're also capable of being complicit in these larger social evils without realizing it. And it's an uncomfortable realization that you are complicit in the oppression of people that you otherwise do think of as your equals and people that you do love and want to protect. You know, the ways that we're always kind of socially maiming each other. And you might feel that someone's foot is on your neck, but what I think is ultimately true is that your foot is often on someone else's. And so, yeah, like Wallace struggles with his own sense of who am I, where am I going? But you're totally right about the larger set of confusions for him being this, you know, what happens in a progressive liberal town when you can feel the pressures of these oppressive hierarchies such as racism, classism, homophobia, sexism, etc. When you can feel it, but they don't realize they're doing it to you, they're exerting this weird pressure upon you. And what happens when you have that awareness and the people oppressing you do not? And how do you begin to negotiate your relationships to them and to the place where you're residing? So yeah, I mean, part of the novel is a very personal novel about existential crisis of people in their mid to late 20s. But I think it's also a novel about the social anxieties around these oppressive structures in our society.
I believe that real life had to be rescued from the bin by one of your friends.
It did. So after I had decided that I was going to be a writer, I sent the book out to a few agents who had represented books I really loved. And they all got back to me with kind but very clear rejections. And I thought, oh, this is a terrible decision that I have made. My writing isn't worth it. So I deleted Real Life and my short story collection from my computer. And then I took the hard copies I had and put them literally into the trash can. And my roommate at the time, who's one of my dear, dear friends, he said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm not a good writer. I'm just going to focus on science because these agents clearly don't want me. If I were a good writer, they would want me. And he told me that I was out of my mind. And he took them out of the trash. And he said, when you deserve these, you can have them back. And he took both of the manuscripts to his office on campus and locked them in and didn't let me have them back until I come to my senses.
Brandon, I believe you've got a very personal reason for being delighted that Real Life is available as an audiobook to blind and partially sighted readers.
Yeah, my dad has been legally blind my entire life, and he has glaucoma and cataracts. And so I've often thought about people who are visually impaired, and it means a lot to me, in fact.
It was a cool evening in late summer when Wallace, his father dead for several weeks, decided that he would meet his friends at the pier after all. The lake was dimpled with white waves. People coveted these last blustery days of summer before the weather turned cold and mercurial. The air was heavy with their good times as the white people scattered across the tiered patios, pried their mouths apart, and beamed their laughter into each other's faces.
Kevin R. Free, narrating Real Life, written by my guest, Brandon Taylor. Something else you've said that rather puzzled me was that writing a novel ruins your life in very specific ways. What do you mean by that?
To write this novel, I had to get inside of it, and I lived that novel for the entire duration I was working on it. So I had no social life. There were no idle moments in my life. The novel really took up all of the space that was available in my mind and in my life that wasn't already taken up by being a doctoral student and working in a lab. It was like having a fever for weeks and weeks and weeks. And when it finally broke, looking back at that time and having no recollection of what you had done, it was really intense. I have relationships that have still not recovered from the 5 weeks I spent on Real Life.
Well, many congratulations on being shortlisted for the Booker Prize. Brandon Taylor, thank you so much for coming onto the show.
Thank you for having me.
The Booker Prize initially awarded £5,000 to its winner. This doubled in 1978 to £10,000, and today the winner receives £50,000. But it's not so bad being shortlisted. Each author who makes the cut receives £2,500 and a specially bound edition of their book.
Mirza Mengistu's Booker shortlisted novel, The Shadow King, is set in 1935 during Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia and shines a light on the African women soldiers who fought in the conflict. Theirs is a story largely forgotten by history, as Mirza told me when she joined me from her home in New York.
The Shadow King opens during Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia in an attempt to colonize it. It tells the story from both sides of the battle lines, the Ethiopian and the Italian. And I feature the women who were fighting alongside the men in the Ethiopian army, a little known fact that I discovered.
I believe there is actually some family history behind this discovery as well.
There is, Red. You know, I found out almost at the point when I was getting ready to submit the final draft of my novel, that my great-grandmother had also enlisted in the war. I had no idea about this while I was writing the book. I thought that I had to be careful with my research and accuracy and make sure I wasn't making anything up. And then the story was also in my family.
She has come by foot and by bus to Addis Ababa, across terrain she has chosen to forget for nearly 40 years. She is 2 days early, but she will wait for him, seated on the ground in this corner of the train station, the metal box on her lap, her back pressed against the wall, rigid as a sentinel. She has put on the dress she does not wear every day. Her hair is neatly braided and sleek, and she has been careful to hide the long scar that puckers at the base of her neck and trails over her shoulder like a broken necklace.
Robin Miles, narrating The Shadow King, written by my guest, Mirza Mengistu. There are two very strong female characters in the book. Hayrat has been sent to work as a maid in the compound owned by Kidana, and his wife, Asta, who is quite a feisty woman.
Yes, Hirut is an orphan. She's working as a maid for this noble family, and they treat her the way that most people would have treated their servants back then, as really inconsequential and somebody that they could order around and do what they wanted with. But Hirut feels like she's more than what people imagine her to be. And this war gives her an opportunity to step forward and gain a level of independence as a soldier. And Aster, too, is a formidable character, someone that is complicated. And people either really like her or they just learn to appreciate her strength, because eventually that works in the favor of the war. And she really thinks that she is just as capable of fighting as the men. And she sees this war as an opportunity to change the course of her life. War creates chaos. And in that chaos, she can create her own destiny and her own fate, completely separate from her husband.
Traditional order has been overthrown, as is evidenced by the fact that the king, Haile Selassie, has fled to England. We see him in interludes throughout the book, trying to make sense of what's going on.
Yes, he can't quite grasp the upheaval that has come. He seems stunned by it, almost to paralysis, and keeps looking at the opera Aida as a clue into the Italian mind. I should say Verdi wrote Aida, and the Italian people had come to love it because it told them something about Ethiopians and Ethiopian girls and women. And he wanted to figure out what that was as a possible clue into the Italian psyche and a clue into how he might be able to defeat these Italians. Haile Selassie left the war and moved to England, to Bath, and watched the war unfold at a distance. And this is something that the fighters never quite forgave him for. And I've always wondered what that must have been like for him to have been so far and to know that on some level, people really were demoralized and did not respect that move.
You also tell the story through photographs that Hyrat has unearthed of the conflict, and from the point of view of a young Italian soldier whose own birthright is catching up with him when he finds out that he has to register as being of Jewish descent.
There's a question that I have been asking, and it is, how is it that decent people end up doing indecent things? And Ettore was somebody that I wanted to explore this with. He's a photographer, and he's soon being ordered by Colonel Fucelli to photograph the atrocities committed on Ethiopians who were captured during the war. And being an artist, he sometimes cannot help the fact that he wants to photograph the prisoners in beautiful ways. He's aware of lighting, silhouettes. He's trying to get the right angle, and he co-opts his own talent in the service of violence. And yet he's Jewish, and he's subjugating a group of people because of their ethnicity. And yet soon the anti-Semitic laws pass in Italy, and he's subjugated to the same kinds of discriminations that he was participating in against Ethiopians. And I know that those cases existed. I know that that's a part of the story of Italy. And I wondered what that does to somebody.
And his duality was also picked up in the character of the Shadow King, who we must mention, who is Hyrat's brilliant solution to who the troops should rally behind when Emperor Haile Selassie has done a bunk to England. And she chooses the lowest of the low and dresses him in emperor's robes.
Yes, his name is Minim. He is a musician. He is a farmer. He is poor. His name in Amharic means nothing. And here's this man that had this uncanny resemblance to Haile Selassie, and Hirut masterminds this ploy to inspire and lift morale amongst the fighters. It's interesting to think about what makes a leader, what makes a ruler. And if a man who says that he can trace his blood back 3,000 years to the Solomonic era, and that justifies his rule as a monarch in Ethiopia, Haile Selassie, if he could be replaced so easily by a poor farmer who has absolutely nothing to his name, what makes a leader?
Did you ever manage to meet your great-grandmother, and would she be proud?
You know, I met my great-grandmother, Red. She was very old when I saw her the last time. She was bedridden, and I was in a room with my relatives, and everyone is gathered around talking about her, reliving instances in her life nobody mentioned the war. Everybody mentioned how strong and stubborn she was, and she'd been known to like beat up men. I'm very short, and she was shorter than me. So I had those stories, and I would like to think that she would be proud of having this story out there, of having this part of her life spoken of, because it just wasn't counted as that important.
Well, Mazlum and Jisti, I'm sure your great-grandmother would be immensely proud, and many congratulations on being shortlisted for this year's Booker Prize.
Thank you so much, Red. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
In 2018, to celebrate the Booker's 50th anniversary, judges were asked to select which previous winner should be awarded the Golden Booker Prize. And the winner was Michael Ondaatje with The English Patient. But back to this year, where I'm delighted to announce that the winner of the 2020 Booker Prize is Douglas Stewart for Shuggie Bain. It's only the second Scottish novel to win the award, after Michael Kelman's How Late It Was, How Late, a book Douglas says has been an inspiration to him. But was it one of the books of his life?
So, Douglas, was there a book that you read as a child or a youth that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
I actually came to reading quite late as a boy. There was just so much going on in my universe around me, and school was a bit of a riot, that I was about 16 or 17 when I managed to really focus on books. But one book as a young man that really stuck with me was Barry Hines's A Kestrel for a Knave, which obviously has also been translated into the really iconic film Kes. But, you know, this was one of the first times I'd ever seen a working class story on the page. If you grew up in the 80s in Scotland, most of what you read was sort of focused on the classics or on middle class authors. And so when I finally read A Kestrel for a Knave, I was just so grateful to see a kid, even though he grew up in Yorkshire, that had a very similar upbringing to my own. Billy Casper is one of my heroes of literature. He is obviously the youngest son of the Casper family, and he's living through this really tough time in the Yorkshire community that he's in, and headed towards the coal mines. His brother threatens him on the first page, who says, "You'll be down the mine soon." And so he sort of has this very ominous future. But then he finds and starts to train and hunt with a kestrel. And it's in those moments that his soul really soars. But home life is really hard for Billy. And the moments that succeed in the book for me are the really small sort of moments of just domestic observation, I guess you would say. I love the scene where we get to see Billy's resilience and perseverance when the schoolmaster asks the class, he's teaching about fact versus fiction. And he asks all the boys to write a tall tale or some wild fiction that couldn't possibly be true. And Billy just sits there and writes the plainest story of small wants. He writes sort of simply and heartbreakingly about coming home to a warm house and finding a hot dinner on the table and coming home to a mother that's not destroyed by drink. And in those moments, that's when the book really sort of gutted me and stayed with me for life.
Jud, what? They'll be late. Oh, shut it. Clock's not fast, I knows. I said shut it. He swung his fist under the blankets and thumped Billy in the kidneys. Gior, that hurts. Well, shut it then. I'll tell me mam on thee. Judd swung again. Billy scuffled away into the cold at the edge of the bed, sobbing. Judd got out, sat on the edge of the bed for a moment, then stood up and felt his way across the room to the light switch. Billy worked his way back to the centre and disappeared under the blankets.
John Davitt narrating A Kestrel for a Knave by Barry Hines, which is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB library. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
My comfort read is As Meat Loves Salt by Maria McCann. I adore this book. I think I've read it about 6 or 7 times. It's set in the 16th century, I believe, at the time of the English Civil War. And if I got the century wrong, don't correct me. I'm not a history buff. But it is the story of Jacob, who is essentially a manservant in a grand house. And we see him in the very first chapter treat his new bride despicably. He runs away and tries to cleanse himself in the bloods of war, as one does, I suppose. But as he battles across England, he actually falls in love with another soldier called Christopher Ferris. At first, everything is beautiful and lovely, but as the two men sort of come apart, we get to really see the depth of Jacob's obsession and his violence. It's a beautifully written and a beautifully researched book. For me, it has all the heft of literary classics, and I believe actually Maria McCann is a historical scholar. But it's also a really important look at queer romance set in history. As a queer writer myself, I don't get to see so much of that. We don't have so many Wuthering Heights or Bronte books. And so As Meat Loves Salt for me does that. It gives me this huge epic romance set against the smoke and the fog of time, and I love it. It's a real bodice ripper, and it certainly rips my bodice.
Unfortunately, there's no audiobook version of As Meat Loves Salt by Maria McCann, but the RNIB Library does have a Braille copy. And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yes, I wanted to recommend this because I actually heard it as an audiobook and I thought it was really phenomenal. It is Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit by Jeanette Winterson. Obviously, this is a real British classic, so it's possible that everyone's already heard it, but I got to listen to the audiobook, and if you can find the version that is narrated by the author herself, you're in for a real treat because the Lancashire dialect is really, really gorgeous. This was one of the books that used to make me feel a bit funny in the library as a kid. It was a big indicator of my own queerness, but it is the story of Jeanette, who is apparently a fictional Jeanette, although the book is somewhat autobiographical. And Jeanette is growing up in the north of England after being adopted by very devout Pentecostal parents. She has been sort of raised into a missionary life, but through her coming of age, she starts to develop sexual attraction to other girls. After her church finds this out about her, they try to exorcise the demons from her. Like, they actually perform a real life exorcism for the gayness, which made me very glad that all the homophobia I faced as a kid was just a quick beating behind the football pitches. But despite this sort of religious exorcism, I find this book a really comforting read. The writing's really suffused with love, and although it kind of looks at the crush of conforming to religious zealotry, it is about finding your true self. And Jeanette Winterson's just a really warm and evocative writer and reader, actually, of the book.
Like most people, I lived for a long time with my mother and father. My father liked to watch the wrestling. My mother liked to wrestle. It didn't matter what. She was in the white corner, and that was that. She hung out the largest sheets on the windiest days. She wanted the Mormons to knock at the door. At election time, in a Labour mill town, she put a picture of the Conservative candidate in the window. She had never heard of mixed feelings. There were friends and there were enemies. Enemies were the devil in his many forms, next door, sex in its many forms, slugs. Friends were God, our dog, Auntie Madge, the novels of Charlotte Bronte, slug pellets, and me at first.
Gretel Davis narrating the RNIB talking book version of Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit by Jeanette Winterson. The version narrated by the author herself is available commercially.
Douglas Stewart, thanks for sharing your love of reading with the Read On listeners, and many, many congratulations on winning the 2020 Booker Prize.
Thank you. It was my huge pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On is always available to download as a podcast. Just search your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. Thanks again to all my guests, and of course, to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.